Four speakers. Lord Lamont will begin. Sir Malcolm Rifkin will be second. Lord Lothian will be third. And Jack Straw will be fourth. I've taken refuge in the lazy chairman's position that none of them need any introduction. But on this occasion, I think it's justified. Norman,
we'll
get there. Please, go.
Well, Ming, thank you very much. I haven't really finished eating my lunch, but thank you so much. I thought you were going to say that when you discovered there was an audience of only one, you were going to say you'd made an appeal to the intelligent voter and you were delighted to have had a unanimous endorsement.
You clearly used that yourself.
Mr. Chairman, this is a very important debate. It isn't one that I have found it very easy to make my mind up on. I, all my political life, have been a supporter of our membership of the Common Market, as it used to be called, the European Union. I voted yes in the referendum in 1975. I made my maiden speech in the House of Commons to join the EEC. The only time I've ever spoken in a rally in Trafalgar Square was with Kenneth Clark in favour of our remaining members of the European Union. But my opinions have over the years gradually changed, as I think the nature of Europe has changed. I remember vividly the 1975 referendum, when we were told this was essentially an economic arrangement, the supremacy of community law, in the words of the White Paper, would be essentially confined to economic matters. And there was no question of monetary union. That was specifically said at the time. I think the European Union has achieved certain things. I think the cutting of tariffs early on in the 60s between the six countries was an achievement. The help given to the post-communist economies and ushering them into the market economy was an achievement. But in the economic sphere, I think the European Union now is largely irrelevant. And we've had an awful lot of reports of different kinds from governmental bodies. I'd like to refer people to a book by someone called Michael Burridge, who was an academic at Harvard, an academic at the LSE, has been a visiting professor at various universities in Asia, who has written an in-depth study of the single market. It's called The Single Market, Myth and Paradox, and you can find it on the website of Civitas, the think tank. It's a 200-page book. And essentially, its conclusions, we've got very limited time, I can hardly say much about it, the conclusions are, firstly, that Britain has benefited least from the single market compared with what it otherwise would have done, and that non-EU members have exploited the single market and benefited it more from it than we have. This may seem completely counterintuitive, but of course, all countries do have access to the EU on certain terms. Some countries have to overcome the very low external tariff that there is of the EU, 3-4%. We pay a tariff through our budget contribution of 9 billion, which is equivalent to 7% on the goods that we actually sell to the European Union. So, you know, we are getting an advantage of paying 7%, whereas they are paying 4%. When it comes to services, where we're always told rules and regulations matter, it is very interesting that actually, if you measure the degree of integration in services by the proportion of GDP, European GDP, represented by services, that has been static and declining. And if you look at the exports of services out of the EU, outside the EU, that is far faster growing than trade in services within the EU. In fact, Mr. Burridge, I think, argues convincingly, this really calls into question whether there is a single market in services at all. And so what I'm really saying to you is that in terms of trade liberalisation and trade generation, I think that happened long ago. I don't think that it's adding today, and I don't think that it is essential to be a member of the European Union in order to sell into the single market, either for goods or for services. So I also look at the possibility of free trade deals elsewhere. And I notice that little countries like Singapore, Chile, Switzerland, when you add up the GDP of the countries that they have signed free trade deals, they dwarf by size those that have been signed by the European Union. There's a very obvious reason and simple explanation for that, and that is that it's much more difficult for the European Union to sign trade deals because it has to act for 28 countries, and it's a much slower process, hence the problems with TTIP. But what I'm trying to say to you is I think the idea that there is this walled garden, the single market, and we've got some key which gives us some preferential terms, I don't think it's true any longer, and I don't think it benefits us any longer. I say all that because, as far as I can see, the Remain campaign are just saying, because of the single market, well, we've got to put up with immigration, even if it's out of control and we don't really want it, even if we dislike some of the laws that are passed, even if we dislike what the European Court of Justice does, we've got to put up with that because of the single market. Well, I don't believe that that is right. I believe the single market is open on WTO terms or external tariff terms to the rest of the world or the rest of the developed world. My fundamental objections to the EU now are twofold. One, I think the focus is on shoring up the euro, and that will inevitably affect us. And we don't share that objective of shoring. Well, we want it to be shored up, but we don't want to be affected by all the measures. And secondly, and this is my final point, and it is my most fundamental point, I do not believe that a European political union, a United States of Europe, can work. Oh, yes, we'll be told. We don't advocate that. Oh, yes, we'll be told. It never happens. I've been told that all my life. And step by step, every step is justified by economic necessity. But somehow we get dragged into it. And I believe that that is something that in the end cannot work. And the only way in which Europe, I think, can be saved from the inevitable crash that is coming is actually if you get a vote to leave by Britain that causes them to rethink and rethink the architecture of this whole wrong project. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Norman began by saying where he was coming from, so I think I should do the same. When I was Foreign Secretary, Le Monde described me as a Eurosceptic modéré, and it's the modéré which has led me to conclude that Remain is the right option. In the time available, I'm going to spend 2 minutes on the single market, 2 minutes on the foreign and security aspects, and 2 minutes on do we need to get control of our country back again. On the single market, I was Margaret Thatcher's Europe Minister, and the instructions I had from her at that time was forget about the single currency, we'll have nothing to do with it. But the single market, that is what Europe needs, and that's Britain is going to be the main beneficiary. And it's worth remembering, Norman, that when we joined the EU, or common market, then we were the sick man of Europe. 3 day weeks, trade union militancy. Now, much of that was resolved by Margaret Thatcher's own reforms. But the single market clearly has been a massive asset as well. You only have to ask people a few miles away in the City of London, as well as in the rest of British industry. So the single market, if you think about it, is what Brexit themselves said we could continue to have the use of, even if we leave. And they used to quote Norway and Switzerland as examples of how you don't have to be in the EU. And then they did their homework and discovered that Norway and Switzerland, in order to have the rights of the single market, have to allow free movement of labour. And it was only then that they suddenly became disenchanted with it. And then the role model, when asked, what is your role model, to be a European country and not in the single market or not having access to it in the way that Norway has, they used Albania as the model that Britain should aspire to, leading to the Albanian Prime Minister the following day saying, we want to join the EU, if you don't mind. Second point on foreign and security policy. Very, very crucial. I'm not going to make any exaggerations about that. But remember the original reasons why the European community was first formed. It wasn't economic. It was political in the sense that we had had the countries of Western Europe fighting and killing each other for hundreds of years, two world wars in the 20th century, and we were in both of them from day one. And the whole point of the European Union, together with NATO, obviously, was to cement Europe so that external security, military security, was provided by NATO. But the countries of Europe formed a community mainly based on economic considerations, and that way would lose the old aggressive habits. And it's worked to that extent brilliantly, so brilliantly, that the countries that have escaped from Soviet domination and have recovered their own freedom, what is the first thing that the Poles and the Czechs and the Hungarians did? They applied to join the European Union. So if we leave the European Union, it won't be a third world war. I don't come up with that nonsense, nor did the Prime Minister, incidentally. It was the newspaper headlines that suggested that. What we do say is that for Britain to leave would begin a massive fragmentation of Europe. Others might follow. Whatever happens, you would then have growing instability in Europe. And we know that when unions of any kind disintegrate, sometimes there is conflict. Often there is conflict. We saw it in the Balkans. We saw it in the Soviet Union when it disappeared. Of course, Western Europe is different. But don't assume that because for one generation, 60 years, 70 years, we have not had conflict in Western Europe, it could never come back again. And it would be more likely, I've said I wouldn't exaggerate, it would be more likely if we cease to be part of common European institutions. The third point is perhaps the slogan that Brexit had used, which has been most resonant, and that is, give us back our country. We want control. If that was valid, if we had lost sovereignty in any real fundamental sense, then I'd be voting on the other side. But look at what's, ask yourself, this is facts I'm going to share with you. Ask yourself what sovereignty means. First of all, it means who decides whether we go to peace or war, to send the troops out to fight in our wars. In the Falklands, in the Gulf, in Iraq, whether there were good wars or bad wars, the decision was taken here, not in Brussels. The second most important example of sovereignty, the power to tax. That's what we had the Civil War about in the 17th century, whether it was Parliament or the King that had the power to tax. Who decides the taxes in this country? Not Europe. It's the Chancellor of the Exchequer recommending to Parliament and the House of Commons, not even the House of Lords, deciding what that should be. And that remains true and will remain true for the future, not just for our sake, but for Germany and other countries who share the same view. What is the biggest budget the government has, and we all pay towards? The social security budget on pensions, on benefits and so forth. That's not decided by Brussels. And the National Health Service, and our schools, and our universities, and all these other aspects. Now, we do have some aspects of supranationalism, of course we do. Overwhelmingly, they fall into two categories, farming and the single market. And on farming, the vast majority of farmers, according to the National Farmers Union, have said we want to stay in the European Union. And that leaves the single market, which Brexit itself said we would remain in by following the Norwegian model until, as I said a few moments ago, they did their homework. So the question of sovereignty has to be assessed. Yes, sir, we have shared sovereignty on the single market. Even Margaret Thatcher wanted that to happen. She said to me and to my colleagues, we will even have majority voting on the single market, because otherwise the French, as a protectionist country, will probably try and prevent us ever achieving it. So it would be ironic if Britain, we are told correctly, it's the fifth largest economy in the world. If we are the fifth largest economy, the strongest economy in Europe at the moment, if we have the lowest unemployment, which is why so many people want to come to Britain for jobs, we can hardly simultaneously argue that the European Union has held us back, that the European Union is destroying our economy, that we're doing worse than we would otherwise do when we're already ahead even of Germany in terms of economic growth and unemployment in terms of most of the other countries, of all the other countries, virtually, of the European Union. So the sovereignty argument is part of the debate. Sometimes it makes sense to share sovereignty in limited areas. I would share it, for example, in environmental pollution. When Chernobyl had a disaster, the nuclear reaction of Chernobyl, Welsh farmers found their sheep were infected. So you cannot deal with these sort of problems simply at national level, so you share sovereignty. We share sovereignty in NATO. That's why de Gaulle was so upset about it. And I don't remember people being upset in this country because we realized it made sense. So if you believe the single market makes sense, and if you accept that the farming community, not every one of them, but the vast majority, we are told, also support it, and if the European Court of Justice's jurisdiction is only limited to those matters involved in the European treaties that have to be interpreted, then I think we should be robust about this. I think we should explain clearly and succinctly to our fellow citizens. And I think the conclusion has to be that after 40 years of membership, we owe more to Europe and they owe more to us and to break that link with 27 other countries and go into some splendid isolation. In terms of our relationship with Europe, which we don't need to do, which we already achieve our basic interests by having the best of both worlds. We're not in the single currency, we're not in Schengen, we're not committed to ever closer union, that's already been agreed. That seems to me a pretty sensible deal.
I go under both names. Malcolm, as usual, made a very compelling speech, but despite that, I have to say, after much soul-searching, I, on the 23rd of June, will vote to leave the European Union. What I want to do today is to try and explain why. I haven't campaigned in this referendum campaign because I believe these decisions are essentially personal decisions, and that is where I'm coming from. I'm not anti-European. My grandmother was Italian, and I'm immersed in European culture. I long ago signed up to de Gaulle's vision of a Europe of nations from the Urals to the Atlantic. But this referendum is not about Europe. It's about the European Union, and that is very different. One is about cultural empathy, the other about political ideology. We're rightly told that this decision is a once-in-a-generation decision, or even possibly a once-in-a-lifetime decision. It's not about tomorrow, and it's not even about the next 5 years. It's for a period within which massive developments can occur and changes be made without further recourse to the people. And that is what this debate should be about. In 1975, I voted for the Europe of Nations, which Heath and Wilson assured me I was voting for. For the next 40 years, I watched that concept dissolve into a systematic and undemocratic movement towards a united Europe. I shouldn't have been surprised. My father's predecessor in title, Philip Lothian, who was an ideological supranationalist writing before the war, wrote certain things which were very influential on the founding fathers of the European Union. Indeed, his words are posted above the entrance to the visitor centre of the European Parliament, and I quote, "National sovereignty is the root cause of the most crying evils of our time. The only final remedy for this evil is the federal union of the people." And that is what the European Union is about. That belief still drives our colleagues in Europe forward. As Donald Tusk, the Council President, said last week, and I quote, "obsessed with the idea of instant and total integration." Although I don't decry that project, and I respect those who genuinely believe in it, I profoundly disagree with it. Let's not fool ourselves. That is what the European Union is and will continue to be about. I'm a Democrat. If the people of this country decide to vote for that genuinely, then I will accept that. But that is not what the Remain campaign is offering. Indeed, in many ways, they're doing their best to disguise it. They say somewhat condescendingly, stop worrying. It's never going to happen. That's perhaps a précis of what Malcolm was saying, but it was essentially the message behind it. And yet, year by year, for the last 40 years, the EC and then the EU has moved inexorably in that direction. They say Remainers have the confidence to reform it from within. Well, I have to say, I've heard that argument for the last 30 years. And all I've seen is Europe moving inexorably in the opposite direction. And when I've argued for reform, as I've consistently done, I've been told by our European partners that to do so would require the reopening of the so-called ACquis, the collected fundamental laws of the EU. And they then tell me that the ACquis cannot be reopened. It is, by deliberate design, the one-way ratchet towards the country called Europe. And the concept of EU reform is for the fairies. It isn't going to happen. For the last 30 years, not least as Shadow Foreign Secretary, I've argued for a return to the concept of the Europe of Nations, only to be told by my European colleagues to forget it. Europe is still, as it always has been, and as its founding fathers intended it to be, a train on a single track to a fully integrated united Europe, however long that might take. And that, to me, is what this referendum is about. Not tomorrow, or the next 5 years, not about a reformed Europe. If a Europe of Nations were still a genuine option, I would vote for it. The choice for me is now stark. On the one hand, the European project of a fully integrated Europe, within which, for all our opt-outs, we would in the end become a mere region. Or on the other hand, embracing in our hearts our courage and our national self-belief, and not for the first time in our history, taking our destiny back into our own hands. None of us can clearly see the future. and many of us will not live long enough anyway to see much of it in any case. But I feel deeply in my bones that for my grandchildren, the best option must be as a nation once again free to decide our own destiny. That has, through history, always been our strength. And that is why on the 23rd of June, I will vote to leave.
Thank you very much, Ming. Ladies and gentlemen, I think this is, one starts off with a confession about what one did in 1975. And of the four of us, I think I'm the only one who not only voted no, but worked in the no campaign. So, as Norman has gone one way, and I think Michael, I've gone the other way. And I came to that view in the 1980s, that our future lay within Europe, and that view was confirmed when I became a minister. There were occasions when I was a minister, not only as Foreign Secretary, but also doing the Justice and separately Home Affairs jobs, where I had to negotiate at very great length with our European partners. And sometimes, particularly late on a Friday, I wished I was anywhere but in an airless room in Brussels, or worse, in Luxembourg. But what kept me going were three things. First, that with patience and care, it was almost always possible to reach an agreement in the interests of the United Kingdom. I can't recall a single occasion where I was party to an agreement which was against our interests, and that's shown by the data. Despite the miss, 97% of the votes in the last 12 years on qualified majority voting, we have won and not lost. For the avoidance of doubt, I didn't have anything to do with the ones we lost. Second, in this process, of course, some compromises are needed. But it's a myth of the Leave campaign that these compromises always involve a zero sum. It's not true. One of the fascinations about the European Union is that for member states, their politics is very asymmetrical one with another. So what's a vital national interest in one state may not matter in the least in another. And the challenge, if you're negotiating, is to make concessions which do matter to the other side, which don't necessarily matter to you at all. Third and most important, I used to reflect that this method of reaching agreement, resolving conflicts, was, as Malcolm said, a far better way of dealing with the fissiparious differences which are there in Europe than the old method, which was the resort to the killing fields. And it is not true, as again the outers suggest, that NATO has been the only reason why we have stayed safe for the last 70 plus years. NATO was dealing, and still deals, with an external threat. What the European Union has dealt with has been the internal threat. And the internal threat, if you think of Europe's history, has always been far greater to our peace and security than that from outside. We weren't invaded or threatened in the last century by Russia or by Turkey, but by other European nations. And those who suggest that, well, this really doesn't matter, we could, for example, carry on with defence, intelligence, security cooperation. Of course, there'll be some, but they ignore the fact that this kind of cooperation, not domination, but cooperation, critically depends on trust, on the closeness of institutional and personal relationships. And they would be undermined if we left the European Union. Let me now come to the issue which has become at the heart of this referendum debate, which is migration. I understand more perhaps than most about the effects which large-scale immigration can have on an indigenous community. 50 years ago, my former constituency of Blackburn, with which I still have very close contact, was all white. Now, 30% and rising of the people in Blackburn are Muslim, and where there were churches, there are now mosques. And altogether, in that town, there are 30 mosques. But this migration, bar a tiny handful, all came from outside the European Union, from South Asia. British governments, the British Parliament, British people had complete control over this migration. But it allowed it and continues to allow it because of the economic benefits which it brought and brings. And one of the questions to the leavers, on which they've been completely silent, since more than half the net migration to this country comes from outside the EU, the EU has absolutely nothing to do with it. What controls are they intending to impose on that? It's a question on which they've been completely silent. As for EU migration, well, again, if you look at our economy, I mean, the out is kind of it both ways. Yes, our economy has been doing better than most European countries. One of the reasons why it's been doing better, one of the reasons why GDP has grown, is because we have more people in this country who contribute to a growth in the economy. If we had a shrinking population, other things being equal, our economy would shrink. And we need those people, not only highly skilled people, but people to work in factories, yes, and people to work in agriculture. I'm insanely proud to be British. And I buy British whenever I can. So if I see, for example, strawberries or raspberries, one with a Union Jack on them, one with something else, I always go for the Union Jack. But just remember that we wouldn't have those British strawberries without EU workers to pick them. Then, finally, there is the issue of sovereignty. I don't understand the defeatism of the Leave campaign when they raise this issue. Sovereignty is not isolation. Sovereignty is how we exercise the greatest degree of control to benefit the lives of our people in a highly interdependent world. Now, Michael said something which really shocked me. He said that this vision of the United States of Europe, which, let me say, since I remember the campaign acutely in 75, we lost by a very large margin, the vision of a united Europe was there. The people of Britain were not sold apart. This vision of the united Europe, not United States of Europe, but united, closer union, comes out of the trauma of two world wars in Europe, in which a trauma which affected us as well as others. So it's the opposite, if you like, of a disunited Europe. But there's no way, if we stay in the European Union, we're going to, in Michael Ancram's words, Michael Logan's words, become a mere region. We will stay in control of the fundamentals, as Malcolm has spelt out. And don't forget that for all this stuff about overpowering EU regulation, Britain remains the second least regulated economy in the industrialised world, second only to Netherlands in an OECD report. And guess what? Both those countries are in the EU. A vote to leave would be a dangerous gamble with the lives of our children and our grandchildren. It's not a risk which I'm prepared to take. We are stronger, more prosperous and safer within the European Union, not outside. Thank you very much.